for argument in Titan versus XL when the council is ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Neil Hovix, 21984, on behalf of the appellant plaintiff, Titan of the Rockies, and Dan Delahoy. Titan of the Rockies started a motorcycle retail service business back in 2001. They were selling motorcycles, they were repairing them, they had a dealership. After about being in business for about a year, they were approached by one of their competitors, the XL Motorsports Company. XL Motorsports was a very mature company. They'd been in business for decades. They had at least three stores, and they had various different corporate names, but they were been around a long time. They approached Titan and the Rockies, and a transaction was entered into, whereby they acquired the assets of Titan and the Rockies. Now, a key part of that transaction was that they occupied Titan and Rockies' location at 8400 West Colfax in Lakewood. Very large facility. It used to be a supermarket. Okay. After about a year, there was the disagreements, and the contract was terminated. We had a lawsuit over that, and there was a jury trial, which we filed in 2005, and we had the jury trial in June of 2007. Titan and Rockies prevailed on breach of contract and breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealings and contract. We defeated the counterclaims. Now, a funny thing happened right before the trial is that the XL Motorsports Group liquidated all their assets. And we learned about this right before trial, and all the real estate was being sold. And I, excuse my throat, I, of course, suspected that if there was a purchase of the business, there's probably a promissory note. And if I won a trial, I can probably garnish that promissory note. And sure enough, that's what I did. Except when I garnished the promissory note, the new buyer, G-Force Power Sports, said, well, the holder of the note, the seller, is not the subsidiary XL American. It's the parent company, XL Motorsports. Now, a key portion of this whole trial was who the XL entities were. XL Motorsports operated three stores, and XL American was formed just to do the transaction with Titan and the Rockies. So XL American had the transaction with Titan and the Rockies, occupied 8400 West Colfax. When they terminated that transaction, they moved to 7700 West Colfax. And that's key, 7700 West Colfax, because that's the business that was sold right before the trial. Now, the complexion of this corporate structure was very important in the trial, because I sued them all, but I only got to get the entity that was on the contract, XL American. So after the trial, and I garnished the promissory note, and I saw the answer that said, no, it's the parent company, I cried foul to the trial court judge, who was obviously very familiar with this case by this time, 5-day jury trial. A trial court judge said, smelt the rat, and he knew what was up. He goes, well, we discussed the fact that XL American was always that entity at 7700 West Colfax, and if these guys just sold, that's XL American. So I asked for an injunction so that all payments under that promissory note, which was considerable, $500,000, and I was told there was a $550,000 payment coming due any minute, that I want those funds put into a court registry until we can have a traverse hearing on this. And the judge, as an ex parte motion, with no response from the other side, signed it right away. And that was senior court judge Jack Smith. And not only did he sign it once, he signed it three times, because we had to tweak it three times to make sure everybody was going to abide by it. So right away, put it under him, he signed it. Of course, Judge Jack Smith, also awarded me attorney's fees. So now while we're going to a traverse hearing, we have an appeal on the attorney's fee award. So a year and a half goes by. I win the appeal, get my attorney's fees for that as well. Now we're back at the traverse. Jack Smith is still there because he is the senior judge. He's only helping out the regular judge. But this is Judge Gerald Rafferty's courtroom. And as much as I tried to get my hearing in front of Jack Smith, everybody had too much of a conflict, between attorneys. Wound up being with Judge Rafferty. So be it. Now, in this time period, I got to do discovery. and I did a discovery of the XL Motorsports world, had what's their corporate world. And I thought, because I wanted to show that historic 7700 West Colfax was indeed XL American, and XL American didn't just disappear. That was a store that was there. And I produce evidence at the Traverse that was voluminous. I produced a lot of evidence. Everything that I could ask for to show that there's a corporate existence that goes on from a lease termination at the closing when they sold the store at that location, bank records, insurance certificates, personal property tax records with the with Jefferson County, was all there. Everything I wanted to show that there was a corporate existence. The only thing I could ask for more would have been a written confession. You know what? I had that. Listen, discovery, I asked them. I said, who's operating a 77 in West Colfax? And under oath, in interrogatory responses, they responded, XL American is operating 77 in West Colfax. And that question was asked in 2005, and they were referring to the dates in 04 that admitted XL American commenced business at 7700 West Colfax, 6104. I had it in their answers. I had it in their interrogatory responses. I had a signed confession. I had tons of documents. So what happens when I go to the Traverse hearing and I present all this stuff? I get the excuse. It was a mistake. And Judge Rafferty said, I presented no credible evidence. Zero credible evidence. And if volumes of business records and signed pleadings, the president of the company, the manager of the company, was a Colorado attorney. They were represented by counsel, lots of counsel. They were sophisticated. They knew what they were doing. They weren't making mistakes.
Well, let me ask you a question about the meaning of no credible evidence. As I read the trial court's order, and you tell me, it sounds like you disagree with the way I'm reading it, but as I read it, he's saying, I'm not convinced by your claims, as opposed to saying you presented absolutely nothing.
I interpreted, he used the word no credible evidence repeatedly. And it wasn't like it was a weight of it up and down. It was like zero. Didn't acknowledge it one bit. Now, I have
to say, let me follow that up, if I may. If that's the problem, the remedy would be a remand for the trial court to then reassess the evidence. And if he comes out the same way, you're back on appeal saying, well, the evidence is more than sufficient. But I'm not sure you want just a remand of the trial court saying, you know, tell us, we think there was some credible evidence. Tell us what you weigh and how you weighed it and how you reach the conclusions. But that's not what you're asking for, as I understand.
Well, obviously, I would want to have a remand with direction from the court about with what the weight of this evidence is, and that I have fulfilled my burden of proof to show that this entity was, in fact, the entity operating at that time.
But Mr. Movitz, on what authority are you relying to tell us that we have that ability to make a credibility determination, to tell the court what weight it should be given to your evidence?
Well, I find that their findings was just basically contrary to the evidence. There was evidence, sufficient evidence, to show that this entity was in fact, and that their findings was inconsistent with the evidence. Evidence just is not supported. I mean, I had presented a timeline to them. All these documents fit out. And then I put in here the findings, paragraph 28 of findings. XL American was dormant on 6/04. Well, on 6/04, that's the same day that the answers were admitted that XL American commenced business at 7700 West Colfax.
But let's take that as an example. The trial court, in its ruling, made credibility findings about witness testimony that supposedly explained that. Now, there's a finding there about credibility. don't we have to presume that the record, we don't have the testimony. Nobody gave us the testimony. Mm-hmm. So don't we presume that the court's findings are supported by the record?
Well, the record that I submitted was all the evidence that I had presented at the court.
Oh, that's not right. You put on 5 witnesses.
All my witnesses are strictly to introduce the evidence.
How do we know that? We don't have the transcript. You say that in your brief, but how do we know that?
Well, if their testimony supported it, I think they would have called to the record. I wouldn't have put the record in, the transcript into the record, because it doesn't support me. I mean, it just supports my conclusions. Their findings, the trial court's findings was not supported by the evidence.
Here the trial court makes credibility findings on the very issue that you're giving this as an example. And he says, this is the way I come out. What do we do with that as an appellate court?
Well, I'm asking you to weigh the evidence and see, you know, the case law says that if the evidence does not support the findings, then the findings can be overturned.
Don't we have to look at it, though, in the light most favorable to the prevailing party? Isn't that our standard of review?
Yes, but I find in this case, it was just the paper record and the paper trail and court pleadings have absolutely no weight if the trial court judge is going to be able to just disregard all that. I mean, I'm not talking, I just had a few things. There was an awful lot of evidence, an awful lot of paper trail, and it just renders it all meaningless. All the stuff that we do. Why did we give these pleadings and ask these people questions, and they can just be discounted with a flick of the hand. I think what happened in this case is the problem was that courtroom was distracted. As respectfully, Gerald Rafferty, they were doing the Marshall Fields murder case. The whole time I was competing with that case. Right from the very beginning. And in fact, when the Traverse hearing was going on, they were doing death penalty hearings for those killers. And they, you know, the judge walked into that courtroom and it was like, got this businessman who's, you know, is an attorney, he's got a well-rehearsed explanation, and poof, it's gone. So I didn't think that was right. And I think that the Judge Smith, he knew what was going on.
You haven't made an allegation.
No, I want to be disrespectful.
But I mean, you go back to the fact that Judge Smith was your original trial judge, but you haven't alleged any error in the change of judges here.
Well, it's procedural. I mean, as I jumped up and down and I made as many motions as I could, and I think I was bushwhacked in that everybody was not available until the original trial court judge had disappeared, was not available. And I had to go, you know, I was like, you know, Judge Rafferty's respectful. You know, he'll do fine by me. But it didn't work out that way. And I think that the evidence was overwhelming. That this simple fact of XL American was totally in existence through that time period. And it was even acknowledged in the closing documents by the new buyer, Chief Force Power Sports. I mean, it was just rampant. And it was just discounted. And I just think that the case law allows the appellate court that discretion that the findings are so inconsistent and so unsupported by the record and the evidence that was presented that it gives you the authority to overturn and send it back with directions.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, I only have a minute. I guess I'll hold on to that.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is David Pocious. I'm from the law firm of Paul Frank and Collins in Burlington, Vermont. I'm here appearing pro hoc vice on behalf of XL American, XL Motorsports, and the junior secured creditors. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for my colleague, Steve Abelman, to present some arguments on behalf of Vectra Bank. I'd like to start off by addressing some of the arguments presented in appellant's reply brief. One argument raised is a distinction between a trial and a hearing. and appellant's attempt to infer that there's some difference here, and that because this is only a hearing, that therefore the testimony presented over the course of 2 days really didn't matter. Appellants here hold the judgment against XL American. They're trying to get the proceeds of a promissory note held by XL Motorsports. Whether it's a hearing or a trial, appellants had the obligation to present the evidence to demonstrate entitlement to those proceeds, and they simply didn't meet their burden doing so. They chose to present documentary evidence and five witnesses over the course of 2 days. They simply didn't meet their burden, and whether it's a hearing or a trial matters little. In the reply brief, appellants suggest that the availability of the transcript cannot be confirmed. That's simply not true. As with all trial courts here in the state of Colorado, a recording is available. If for any reason a recording is not available, the appellate rules provide a mechanism by which the record can be recreated. Appellants didn't assert that one wasn't available. They chose not to order a transcript, in their words, because they didn't think it was relevant and they wanted to save costs. Appellants also suggest that they had no burden or obligation to order a transcript. Both case law and Rule 10b make very clear that appellants have the burden to produce a transcript in this case, and I'm quoting Rule 10b here, Appellate Rule 10b. If the appellant intends to urge on appeal that a finding or conclusion is unsupported by the evidence or is contrary to the evidence, the appellant shall include in the record a transcript of all evidence relevant to such finding or conclusion. That tellingly wasn't done here, and for good reason. Appellant, in their reply brief on page 4, concede that there was a record of witnesses' statements and cross-examination that supported the trial court's findings. They make that admission on page 4 of their reply brief. Appellants here simply chose to ignore any evidence, testimony or documentary evidence that didn't support their case. And that simply falls well short of their burden on appeal when they are trying to claim that the evidence, or rather that the findings were contrary to the evidence presented at trial. Appellants, for the first time in the reply brief, baldly point to certain findings by paragraph number that they believe were erroneous. Unfortunately, appellants fail to explain why any of them are erroneous in light of any particular piece of evidence, and obviously, of course, certainly not in light of any testimony that was presented over the course of 2 days. You know, again, appellants simply choosing to ignore all the evidence that clearly supports Judge Rafferty's comprehensive findings of fact. In appellant's arguments, there was a significant focus on the 2007 trial and Judge Smith. What was conveniently forgotten was that during that trial, appellants tried to hold XL Motorsports liable for any judgment or debt of XL American. What happened in that case was that Judge Smith, like Judge Rafferty, at the close of plaintiff's case, found that as a matter of law, plaintiffs failed to meet their burden to pierce the corporate veil and to hold XL Motorsports liable for any judgment against XL American. That is the same thing that happened in this case. None of the piercing factors supported appellant's argument for why XL Motorsports should be liable. Your Honor's raised the standard of review here and the language of no credible evidence. What's important here is that the standard of review here is not whether there's any evidence, any credible evidence, or any of that. The standard here is whether Judge Rafferty committed any manifest errors in his findings of fact. You know, again, we circle back to the absence of a transcript here, because unfortunately the transcript clearly would have demonstrated the accuracy of Judge Rafferty's findings. Judge Rafferty was the trier of fact. He listened to 2 days of testimony. He listened to the evidence that was presented, and he made very thorough findings of fact. If you read the findings of fact alongside appellant's brief, you can find along the way where Judge Rafferty addressed all these arguments and the evidence that he now presents to this appellate panel. Again, Judge Rafferty sat through 2 days of testimony of 5 witnesses, including the managers of XL Motorsports, the managers of XL American, the manager of G-Force, who purchased the assets of XL Motorsports in November of 2006, and the attorney who handled the transactions on behalf of XL Motorsports, Jim Krendel. To suggest that the testimony was irrelevant, or to suggest that the witnesses were there simply to get documents introduced into evidence, is simply not the case. I'm going to avoid going back to the trial. I was there, and I'm going to avoid trying to explain away a lot of these things, because I don't think it's appropriate here in light of the lack of transcript. But again, if you go back to the findings, you can see where Judge Rafferty addressed all this evidence, these two notebooks of evidence that have been presented to you on appeal. Again, this case goes back to 2002, when XL American and appellant Titan had a contract. XL American was the only entity with whom Titan had a contractual relationship. XL American was incorporated for express purpose of selling American branded street motorcycles, which included the Indian and Polaris lines. These are motorcycles similar to the Harley-Davidson motorcycles. That was the express purpose of XL American. Shortly after the deal with Titan in September 2003, Indian Motorcycles went out of business. At that point, the business model of XL American was simply no longer viable. There was a transitionary period between 2003 and 2004. By 2004, when XL Motorsports opened the location at 7700, XL American was essentially a dormant corporation. It existed on paper for the sole purpose to deal with orphan motorcycles, Indian motorcycles that had no value, had no replacement parts, had no warranty services, but due to Colorado law and the dealer agreements, they had to be sold under the name XL American. As of June 2004, that was the sole purpose of XL American existence. It had no assets, of value, and come November 2006, no assets of XL American were transferred to G-Force. Again, I go back to the findings. All these things were explained at trial, both through the documents and through the testimony, and Judge Rafferty properly found that XL American and XL Motorsports kept their separate identities, same finding that Judge Smith found back in 2007. Appellants raised a number of documentary pieces of documentary evidence, and again, tries to suggest to this court that they somehow lead to erroneous findings or should lead to a reversal. Appellants cannot explain how any particular finding is erroneous. Appellants cannot and have not explained how any particular finding or any finding of erroneous any finding, if erroneous, appellants haven't explained how that should lead to a reversal. Again, Judge Rafferty spent 2 days listening to plaintiff's case. He was the trier of fact. This panel is not the trier of fact. Judge Rafferty was the trier of fact. He listened to all the evidence that plaintiffs presented, and unfortunately for appellants, it simply was not enough. At a bench trial, as a finder of fact, he weighed the evidence, weighed the credibility of the witnesses, and he made his findings. There's no basis to reverse those findings. And if there's no more questions, I see my 10 minutes is up, and I'd like to pass the baton to Attorney Abelman to present some arguments on behalf of Vectra Bank. Thank you.
May it please the court, Steve Abelman appearing on behalf of Vectra Bank Colorado. I'm with the law firm of Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, and Schreck. Your Honor, Vectra Bank was a secured creditor of XL Motorsports and XL American. Our collateral included all accounts receivable, equipment, and inventory. when each of the stores was sold, the net proceeds were paid to Vector Bank to reduce the amount of the outstanding indebtedness incurred pursuant to a loan. The sale to GeForce was no different, except that it was not an all-cash transaction. GeForce paid some cash and also, as part of the purchase price, issued a $500,000 promissory note payable to XL Motorsports. Now, with regard to whether that $500,000 note should have been payable to XL Motorsports versus XL American, Vector Bank takes the position that it was properly directed towards XL Motorsports. Nonetheless, from a legal standpoint, it matters not because Vector Bank's security interest attached to the assets of both XL American and XL Motorsports. The $500,000 note, which was issued at closing, was then provided to Vector Bank. Vector Bank took possession of the note at the closing. The promissory note is an instrument, and under the UCC, the manner in perfecting an instrument is to take possession. With respect to Titan of the Rockies, the sole argument that Titan espouses concerning Vector Bank is that Vector Bank released its security interest in the promissory note. This is a disjointed argument because it is not part of any narrative, any logical narrative. The Titan points to a letter that was dated the exact same date as the closing, November 16th, 2006. And the court found that with respect to Vector Bank, the trial court determined that the evidence demonstrates that at no time did Vector Bank release its security interest in a promissory note it obtained at the time of the GeForce closing in November of 2006. The reason that there's no cogent argument that supports Titan's position is, why would Vector Bank release its security interest in a promissory note on the very day of the closing when it took possession of the promissory note in order to perfect its interest? Why would Vector Bank release its security interest in the promissory note when it was still owed money by the XL entities on the loan? Why would Vector Bank send a letter that didn't reference a release of the promissory note? What the letter says is that Vector Bank is releasing its security interest in the, it says Vector Bank will release its security interest in the equipment, inventory, and accounts receivable, as well as other collateral owned by XL Motorsports LLC at the West Store, 7700 West Colfax Avenue, Lakewood, Colorado, and the Yamaha Store, 8800 West Colfax Avenue, Lakewood, Colorado. So Vector Bank was releasing its security interest in the assets that GeForce was purchasing. GeForce was issuing a promissory note to pay for those assets. So there would be no reason for Vector Bank to release a security interest in an asset other than what GeForce was purchasing. The trial brief by Titan cast aspersions upon the proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, dismissively stating that those were drafted by counsel for Vector Bank and counsel for XL. I just want to mention that they were indeed proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law were drafted by counsel for the appellees. They incorporated the verbal findings of fact and conclusions of law articulated by Judge Rafferty at the end of the hearing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Left, if you wish.
All corporations only exist on paper. If I had to prove that somebody was alive, and this was the paper record of a live person, there'd be no doubt that this person was alive. I mean, same thing with these corporations, and just because there's, you just can't offhand and after the fact say, oh, no, a driver's license was issued for all those years, that person had a lease for that house for all those years, that person was really dead. They were dormant. It just doesn't work like that. And as far as Vector Bank, they made the statement, they released their security interest. I didn't make that statement. And what they were claiming was there was the proceeds from that collateral in the promissory note. That's what they pled. From originally loans from 2004.
So
they made the statement they released their security interest, and they have to live with it.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.